Chris Addison has built his career on laughter as a stand-up comedian, a panellist on shows like Mock the Week, and as an actor and director. You perhaps saw him as Ollie, the hapless junior Whitehall advisor in The Thick of It, the political satire created by Armando Iannucci. Chris has worked as a director on another highly acclaimed comedy, In the Corridors of Power, the Emmy Award-winning Veep, set in and around the White House. He's also created and directed Breeders, a brutally honest sitcom about parenthood, starring Martin Freeman. And he's performed in opera on the stage at Covent Garden, though I should add, Chris, in a speaking role.
In a speaking role, yes. They were very clear contractually about that.
You are an opera fan, and you've chosen Mozart, Rossini, folk music by Eliza McCarthy, but the first piece is by Dvořák.
What I've tried to do with the choices, really, Michael, is to pick things that represent styles and moments for me. So this one, this Bagatelle, I was brought up with a lot of chamber music. My grandmother was from Vienna, and her flat in Stevenage was filled with chamber music. And I remember my dad, who used to work after hours at the dining room table, listening very loud to Schubert or to Beethoven or Middle European stuff often. And quite a lot of Dvořák, the piano quintet, was a great favourite of mine. I loved the sort of lightness, and I'm a simple person, so I quite like a melody, and Dvořák is superb.
And very influenced by folk music.
Absolutely, yeah, hugely influenced by folk music. I think it's classical music that has a real sense of place. With somebody like Dvořák, you're looking at something that comes from the land that he's sort of standing in, even to the point where ultimately, you know, his most famous piece of work is about not being in that place at all, the New World Symphony, you know. So I loved these pieces because they're so bouncy, they're so melodic, they're just joyful to listen to, and they fully remind me of being a child.
Thank you.
What I love about that is it's irrepressible. It's like energy, but without urgency. It's not a march wanting to get somewhere. It's a dance. Even at the point that the piece slows down and the piano and the strings start to sort of talk to each other for a moment in a kind of call and answer, eventually they're talking over each other again. And even in that sort of minor section, the energy picks up and up and up and up. And right at the end, as the piece sort of comes to its quiet end, they're still whispering their last little phrases because they just don't quite want to stop. It's fantastic.
Poco Allegro, number 5 of Dvořák's Bagatelles, performed by the Busch Trio. You mentioned your father at the table. Mm. What was he working on?
He was editing medical textbooks, I seem to remember.
Was he a doctor?
He was a doctor, yeah. He was a consultant in a number of children's hospitals in Manchester.
And you were born in Cardiff but grew up in Worsley in mm-hmm. Salford.
Yes.
Greater Manchester. So music clearly was rather a wonderful part of your life. But did you learn a musical instrument?
I did. One of the many regrets I have is sort of putting it to one side, although it remains in my office. I learned the flute to a reasonably high standard as a kid. My daughter now is a proper flautist. She's done her grade 8 and everything. We're all very proud. And so occasionally I get the flute out. She sort of deigns to come down to my level and we'll play basic Christmas carol duets or something together once a year. But yeah, I sang a lot and I played the flute.
I think singing is very important to you, and it rather speaks to the next piece, doesn't it?
Absolutely it does, yeah. So the next piece is the Dies Irae from Benjamin Britten's War Requiem. I sang the War Requiem as part of the boys' choir when I was just about to turn 12, so in my first year at Manchester Grammar School. And MGS had a really very good chamber choir, which the Halle and the BBC Phil and so on used to use. And so I was very privileged to get to work with those people every so often. And this was my introduction to Britten. I remember my dad giving me a tape and saying, no, you're going to have to listen to this because this isn't like anything that you've heard before. This isn't like the music that you're used to. I wonder sometimes whether it would have stuck with me if I hadn't sung it. So this piece for me is important partly because it represents the beginning of what has turned out to be a lifetime, with a hiatus due to my stupid job, but a lifetime of singing in choirs. And I love this Dies Irae because the famous Dies Irae, of course, is the Verdi, which is a marvellous piece of Catholic camp effect.
Quite operatic.
It's hugely operatic. There are bits that are quite comical, that kind of Dies Irae, Dies, up into the big thing. It starts off with this enormous blast and it goes along at quadruple F for 2.5 minutes before everybody kind of runs out of energy and it dribbles away. And it's this all-encompassing version of the Day of Judgment. What I love about Britten's version is the space in it and the menace. There's so much menace in this. You don't quite know where you are. The instrumentation is rather disorientating, the way that the brass play. You're not quite sure at any given moment whether they're going to be in major or minor. Why is major here? And the slightly whispered approach of the choirs, making it feel like something really terrible is around the corner and we don't want to awake it. Somehow, to me, that is a more terrifying version of the Day of Judgment than the huge Verdi.
And of course, the fascinating thing is what you've just been saying echoes what Britten was doing in combining the Latin Mass with the poems of Wilfred Owen, which were full of what it's like to be in the trenches in the First World War, that dread, that fear, the bombardment, but overall that sense of ominous waiting.
Yes, and in fact, what's interesting, of course, in terms of the First World War is this is about the Day of Judgment, but the whole point, I think, to some extent of the War Requiem is the absence of God, or at least there's a question about whether he is there or not. And I think it's an uncanny listen. It can't fail to get into your bones and unsettle you. Thank you.
Princes of lies were by the river's side. Sleep mothered them and left the twilight sad. The shadow of the morrow weighed on
I remember being in the Free Trade Hall, which is where we sang that, and the boys' choir were placed sort of above and to the side of the orchestra. And I don't think I'd ever experienced that kind of sound before, the power of the brass and the drums sounding like the artillery, and it was terrifying. We'd spent many weeks doing our little angelic bits with a piano in a practice room and stuff. And then suddenly we're in the presence of this enormous noise.
Well, that was the recording where Benjamin Britten was himself conducting the Dies Irae from the War Requiem with the London Symphony Orchestra and the Bach Choir. It's the recording which has Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau as the mellifluous baritone. You studied English literature at Birmingham University, Chris Addison, thinking then, I think, that you wanted to be a theatre director.
I did.
What changed? How did you end up moving towards comedy?
Well, what changed was practicality and laziness were brought to bear on my life. You know, when you're at university or at school, it's really easy to put plays on. There are always going to be like-minded people around to help you do that, rooms to do it. And also, it's very cheap to license things when you're a student. But then once you leave that world and you have to earn some money, it's much, much harder to start to put those things on. So a year or so out of university, I was very creatively frustrated. I was working in temp jobs, and I've always loved comedy. And so I thought I would go and do 5 minutes of stand-up at an open mic night, because although people in general find the notion of stand-up terrifying, it's fine if you are fundamentally a show-off. That's the first thing. But as a logistical exercise, there's nothing easier, right? You just turn up with some words, somebody else sorts out the lights, the microphone, publicises the show, all of that. You just turn up and say stuff. You need no talent at drawing. You don't need to learn an instrument. You just say things. So it is the simplest way to let off creative steam.
What do you remember about your earliest stand-up performances, or would you rather not remember?
No. I think of them often as a sort of cautionary tale. What I remember about my very first stand-up performance was I remember not telling anybody but my brother that I was going to go and do it, because I just was trying to sort of insulate myself from the humiliation. I can remember going to the Frog and Bucket in Manchester, which in those days was this tiny little pub on Newton Street. And I turned up at Doors, which is ridiculous. When's the show start at Doors? It was just me for ages, terrified and nursing one pint because I didn't want to drink too much. And then the next person through the door was Caroline Ahern, who was then nationally famous as Mrs. Merton, and her then husband, Peter Hook, who I loved because he was in the band New Order. And it was just horrifying. And I can remember being up on stage and getting nothing from anybody. Like, it wasn't booze, it wasn't a death in that, but I just got nothing. And I can remember looking over to my left and just seeing Peter Hook's chin resting on his palm, looking at me like I'd murdered his dog or something. It was fully humiliating. And were it not for the fact that the excellent comedian Dave Gorman was in the audience at the time and more or less grabbed me as I came off stage and went, "This audience are terrible, don't worry about that, you've got some good jokes there," I don't know that I would necessarily have gone back. So I owe Dave Well, everything, really.
Well, you were nominated for the Perrier Awards at the Edinburgh Fringe. Do you think that the confidence that you exude on stage is replicated in your own private life? In other words, are you shy? Are you sociable? Oh. Are you the same person when you're at home?
What a very deep and interesting question. I think I'm fairly confident in certain situations. I'm deeply unconfident in other situations. And I'm quite often front-footed in an effort not to be put on the back foot, if that makes sense.
Where do you think your confidence came from?
Well, I'm a huge believer in getting kids to do performance of whatever kind. I wanted to do singing, and I suspect it comes from there. That said, also, I'm immensely privileged. You know, I grew up in a very happy family with very supportive parents. I'm sure that if I'd said, do you know what, I'm not going to be a comedian, I'm going to be a lawyer, they'd have gone, oh, thank goodness for that. But, you know, they're fully supportive, and I was extremely privileged to go to the kind of school that had all of those activities. I honestly believe that one of the great failures of thinking in terms of modern education is the way that music provision has been cut. I'm lucky to live in the borough of Bromley in London, and it has an extraordinary extracurricular organisation called the Bromley Youth Music Trust, which provides incredible opportunities for kids to play instruments in all sorts of ways, or sing, or perform, or be in musicals, or be in choirs, do what they want. And that is missing in education in general. The short-sightedness comes from a belief that it's just messing around with instruments or making tunes, and it doesn't turn anything on a spreadsheet green. But actually, it's about having life skills and a sense of yourself that you can take forward into the world to your benefit.
Eliza Carthy next.
Yes, I love Eliza Carthy. So I like a bit of folk music, me. And I went through a particular sort of folky phase in the late 90s to early noughties, partly from seeing Eliza Carthy accompanying Billy Bragg, of all people, at the Glastonbury Festival. The one time I've ever been to Glastonbury, I was performing in 1997. One of the performances that I would prefer to forget. But what I love about Eliza Carthy is that she takes a tradition that is centuries old. She is extremely respectful of it. She loves it. She roots everything that she does in it. But she chooses to explore how you might expand it and how you might take it somewhere else. So this particular track, Just As the Tide Was Flowing. Now, this is a traditional song, and if you were to look it up on one of your streaming services, you would discover that there are many versions, 2 or 3 minutes long, jokey, folky ballads. And what Eliza has done in this recording from over 20 years ago now is stretched it out and found the space in it. And underneath it, there's a melodeon giving a kind of medieval drone noise, and the fiddle layered over the top of that, which is her instrument. And then her incredible voice, and her voice is extraordinary because it sounds like it comes from the earth that it's describing. It's beautiful. And what I adore about this track is that it's like everything floats away. It's like you're in a sort of white space, like music that gives you a sense of the world not being around you. The sense of floating.
Love.
it's woozy and it's meditative and it's calming. And I love that the way it feels like they're expanding and collapsing the time signature. You never quite know entirely where you are, but you know that they're all watching each other. I think there are approaches to music that are dangerous in folk and classical particularly, where we look at something as being almost in aspic. You know, we try and preserve some kind of Socratic version.
A sacred version.
A sacred version, precisely. Mm. And that's death. Mm. And what I think is so exciting in music is when you hear people exploring the music that they're playing. It breathes real life into it.
Music from Eliza Carth is Just As the Tide Was Flowing from her Anglicana album, released in 2002. Talking about other worlds,
yeah,
which that folk music definitely conjures up, opera does the same thing in a completely different way, doesn't it? It takes,
yes,
you into an escapist world.
Yes.
You are a great fan of opera.
Huge fan of opera, yes. I came to it relatively late. I was very lucky. And my grandmother, who I mentioned, took me to Vienna when I was 13 to see the sort of places of her youth. And she took me at that age to AIDA, the State
Staatsoper.
Opera. Yeah. No, the Staatsoper, exactly. Which is an amazing place to start. And I was blown away by the sort of scale of it. I can remember thinking, it's absurd that that stage could possibly be that big. It's too much to take in. And it didn't quite stay with me. And my parents, a little while later, took me to see Meistersinger. It must have been an Opera North production, I'm guessing, because it was at the Palace in Manchester. Again, didn't really take. And then I was just sort of doing some work in the Home Office, and I was sort of looking around for something to play that I hadn't played. And there was a box of my wife's CDs, and on top of it was Magic Flute. And so I'll play that. And that is a great way into opera, because it is wall-to-wall bangers, all killer, no filler. It is an astonishing piece. But anyway, it hooked me in, and 25 years later, I'm still here.
That was in the office in your home rather than in the Home Office in Whitehall.
That's right. Yes, it wasn't in the Home Office. Yeah, they just have my wife's CDs lying around in the Home Office. It's how they fund things.
I can't help wondering whether there isn't something about opera which is inherently comic.
Oh, absolutely. One of the problems with trying to get it across to a wider audience is the fact that you really do have to put your sense of irony and comedy at the door often if you're going to take seriously what you're about to see, because the stories are insane. They're absurd, and the way that they're sort of presented also is kind of mad. You have to approach story on a different level than you would if you were reading a book, watching a TV show, listening to The Archers, whatever. It is inherently slightly over the top, I think, particularly for English sensibilities, because we are a country suffused in irony. Watching a mad scene, it's hard not to go, come on, come on.
I want to know about your starring role in Cabrier's comic opera L'Étoile in 2016 at the Royal Opera House.
So in Chabrier's L'Étoile, which wasn't that often performed, although there have been a few productions recently, it's a lovely, very funny opera, very short, great tunes, well worth getting to know. And in it, there is a policeman who's there for like 2 minutes. But the director, Mariam Clément, who is brilliant, went, actually, do you know what? I want to tease that character out. And she made him into two characters, an Englishman and a Frenchman, Smith and Dupont. And I played Smith. Her approach was, and I think this is a good approach, that opera, L'Étoile, is fully mad. Like, it doesn't even pretend not to be mad. But quite often, what directors will try and do is mitigate the madness. And she said, what we should be doing is running towards it, turning all the dials up. And so she turned it into this sort of Python-esque romp. And what that meant was, it meant I got to sit in a rehearsal room in Covent Garden for 6 weeks with the likes of Kate Lindsay and listen to them do their thing up close. And it was absolute catnip.
You've become a fan of bel canto, haven't you? Or what chorus members with some tenors call can belto.
yeah, I have. Again, I came to that quite late. I came to that because my bus was late. I was waiting for a bus outside my train station. There's an Oxfam shop. I just went in to have a look at the records, and there was a Best of Joan Sutherland and Richard Bonning. I mean, that is all bel canto, and it was fantastic. Beautiful singing. That's what it's supposed to be, isn't it? Bel canto. One of the reasons that I love bel canto, obviously there are great tragedies, Lucia de Lammermoor and all of that, but the comedies, The Barber of Seville is the most famous, I suppose. The comedies are A Hill I Will Die On, is comedy is harder than drama. It just is, because you have to do the same things, but with jokes. And it's so much tougher to make people laugh than to make them cry. And I'm fascinated by the way that Rossini and Donizetti and Bellini were able to make their music complex, difficult to do, really high-level stuff, but seem light and fizzy and funny. So if you think about Largo al Factotum, which is Figaro, 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 that song, and the way that he forces the singer into singing at such incredible speed with such astonishing precision, it's a patter song. You can draw a line from Largo al Factotum through You Got Trouble from The Music Man down into Hamilton. It's all part of the same thing. And the next track that I've chosen, actually, is from a couple of years after Largo al Factotum. Rossini wrote La Cenerentola, which is Cinderella, basically. And there's this fantastic moment where courtiers arrive to explain to the terrible sisters and the father, stepfather rather than an evil stepmother, that the prince is coming and he wants to find a wife. Basically, everybody goes into a panic. Cenerentola is being nagged and she's going, "Ah," like Figaro, she's going, "Oh God, everybody's telling me what to do." And Rossini manages to put all these lines in together to have that many people singing and it sound precise and light. It's sort of a miracle.
Oh,
And then they go on and sing some more stuff as though they're not completely out of breath. How is that even possible? It's sort of like when you watch an athlete being interviewed after a game and you go, how are you talking? Why aren't you dead?
It's wonderfully light and airy, isn't it?
Yeah, and the thing about light and airy is that it always has a huge and delicate mechanism behind it.
But soufflés.
Yes, and the trick is hiding it. Because the minute you see how it's done, it's dead. It sort of has to present itself as simplicity itself when it is nothing of the kind.
Ophelia Amabili from La Cenerentola by Rossini. We heard the choir and orchestra del Teatro Comunale di Bologna, conducted by Riccardo Sciai. And amongst the cast was no less than Cecilia Bartoli.
I'm going to guess she was Cenerentola.
You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest this week is the comic actor and director Chris Addison. In 2005, The Thick of It first appeared on our screens, a comedy series that satirised the inner workings of British government. Tell us a bit about the part you played, a character called Ollie Reader, which actually I do remember very well.
Well, Oliver Reader was a young SPAD, a special advisor to initially the Minister for the Department of Social Affairs. He was a callow political animal, really, Ollie. He sort of represented the fact that actually when you hang around politics, there are an awful lot of very, very young people who know nothing other than politics, but don't even know very much about that. And Ollie was that person. Lots of ambition, very little talent.
Yes, he was described by one of the characters as a little bit morally bankrupt and massively self-centred and a tiny bit dangerously unreliable. Rather fun to play, I would have thought.
Yeah, enormous. I mean, the whole thing was unbelievably good fun because so much of it was very playful in the way that we made the show. It was terrifying to some degree, but it was also a lot of fun in that we had these copper-bottom brilliant scripts by Jesse Armstrong and Simon Blackwell and Tony Roach, who were later joined by other writers. But on top of that, we're given permission to, and indeed instructed, to free up a lot of the dialogue
improvise.
And acting and improvise. Yeah. So typically we would shoot a take that was absolutely on the script and one at the other end that was sort of nowhere near the script where you were just sort of following the beats of the scene. But mostly it would be somewhere in between those things. Peter Capaldi, who played Malcolm Tucker, would tell you that he absolutely learned the scripts completely because there's such sort of poetry in Malcolm's invective that he didn't want to mess it up.
I think we won't go into any of that on Radio 3 moment at midday.
No.
Many of the storylines were very close to what was going on in the real world, highlighting conflicts between politicians, spin doctors, civil servants and the media, and coined the phrase omnishambles.
Did. Omnishambles made it into the OED, in fact.
Is that still the case?
Well, I know that most days on social media, somebody gets in touch with me and says, please, can we have another Thick of It? Because it feels like it's time. But I do feel like it's gone because satire exists in the place between the facade of competence that politicians put up and the reality of the chaos that's going on behind the scenes. But the facade fell down a long time ago. You know, post-2016, nobody really believes in the competence of politicians to the point where we've got a genuine problem. And because of that, I don't know that you could make The Thick of It in the same way.
Well, Wollum Green next, and this certainly brings the spirit up, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I love this. It's from The English Dancing Master, which was a book put together by John Playford in the 17th century. But this performance is by Beata Eicher and the Alehouse Boys, which is a project of Baroque Solistene, which is Beata Eicher's amazing Norwegian Baroque music project. And this whole album that they released 6 years ago was based on the idea that during the interregnum, after the death of Charles I, music was banned in the churches, theatre was banned, and so the musicians were forced into the taverns. Musicians, of course, never want to go into taverns, so it must have been very difficult for them. But they were forced to go into the taverns to perform, and this whole album is about the experience of what that music would have been. It's an attempt to sort of reconstruct some of it. So there's quite a lot of Purcell in there, there's quite a lot of John Playford, folk. But what interests me most about the project, I think it's my favourite classical album of the last 10 years, probably, is them as a group and how they perform. If you ever get the chance to go and see them perform this live, I cannot recommend it enough, because it's about the interplay between the audience and the players. They are the best players of their instruments, but there's a playfulness and there's an inventiveness that's happening on stage that makes everything feel alive. Going back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, not having music in aspect, that's what's so exciting about it. I think sometimes when we talk about music, and listen, Radio 3 Till I Die, right? This and Radio 6, these are my stations. But sometimes on Radio 3, if I listen to Record Review, and Record Review says something like, well, some of the vibrato on the strings there, not to my taste, or whatever, I find myself going, shut up. Because what they're trying to define is actually ineffable. It's charisma. Charisma, or what, before Simon Cowell had ruined the phrase for us, we would have called the X factor, is the thing that you're generally trying to define when you're talking about what you do or don't like about a piece of music. And Beata Eicke and his Alehouse Boys are all charisma, inhabiting the music rather than just playing the dots.
It's extraordinary how much music, Chris, actually derives from dance, whether you're talking about Mozart, Beethoven or Britten.
Yes.
Dance is often there, right in its origins.
Absolutely. What should be your response to an awful lot of music is, I want to be out of my chair.
Wallam Green, from The English Dancing Master by John Playford, performed by the Alehouse Boys. You've co-written a series called Breeders with Martin Freeman and Simon Blackwell. It's a brutally honest sitcom about parenthood. The final series is on Sky Comedy at the moment. What took you in that direction?
Credit where credit's due. So I have co-created it with those gentlemen. Simon is the writing genius behind it. Martin started the whole business by pointing out that we haven't really seen in sitcom a depiction that is brutally, brutally honest about what it's like to be a parent, about the guilt, the anger, the way that you change your view of yourself as a person. There are aspects of yourself that you had no idea about until this child, this challenge comes along. So we wanted to see if we could make a show that we felt was honest and realistic. And in fact, it's been lovely that an enormous number of people have sort of contacted us saying, oh, thank God it's not just me. I thought it was just me who was like that. And obviously our characters are sort of, you know, for dramatic purposes, the dials are turned up a little. But yeah, we wanted to write something that we felt we hadn't seen.
Did you enjoy the writing process?
Do you know what? It was extraordinary. So it began with the three of us having a series of long lunches that were really more like father support groups. You know, we were saying things about our own guilt, about our own experiences that we never said to other people.
And you have two children.
I do have two children.
Yes. And what do they make of it?
They haven't seen it. It's not their sort of thing. I'm sure if somebody cuts it up into 15 pieces and puts it on TikTok, eventually they'll see it. But no, I'm being unfair to my children there for comedic purposes. But actually, no, it's not really their thing.
Christmas music next, which probably is their thing and is a real passion of yours.
Oh, I'm obsessed with choral Christmas music, which is partly a Proustian thing. You know, when I hear certain arrangements from the Green and Orange Carols for Choir books, I am transported back to my school days and singing in that choir. In fact, in my bag I have with me Carols for Choir 6, which has just been published. So I'm just going through the new stuff. On my streaming services, they regularly put together playlists that say, for you, and it's just Christmas music, because I investigate it from about September on. I'm so obsessed with it. And I think I always loved it. I think there's a feeling of winter about it that I like. I'd like things that feel like they connect you to a distant past. So the carols that I generally like have a somewhat pagan feel to them. They've got holly and ivy and hearts in the wood and all of those kinds of things. Over the last few years, I sort of discovered a Scandinavian carol tradition, which is fantastic. This is from about 100 years ago, and it's a piece called Jul, Jul, Strålende Jul by Gustav Nordqvist. It was written in, I think, 1921, and it's become a full-on Swedish classic. But I hadn't heard it. To my delight, last Tuesday, I got an email from my choir saying, could you print out this music, please? We're going to sing this year. So I'm thrilled, but it's a little jewel. It's almost in barbershop territory. It flirts with close harmony. And it feels like Christmas from another place, but it feels like a Christmas that you fully know.
Jul, Jul, Strålende Jul, with lyrics by Edvard Evers and music by Gustav Nordqvist, sung by the Adolf Fredericks Church Choir. What are you working on at the moment? I heard rumours of something called Hallelujah, Handel's Messiah.
I hope we will get to make that. That has been a project that has been rumbling on for years and years and years. Funnily enough, I was thinking of it yesterday. It was going to happen before the world shut down. But yes, there is a film that I'm attached to direct, which is called Hallelujah, which is about the first performance of Handel's Messiah in Dublin in 1742. And it's a comedy that is somewhat true. It takes a number of liberties with the truth, but there are so many great stories around that particular performance of that particular piece of music. Yeah, it's a passion project. Hopefully one day we'll get it on its feet.
You had Ralph Fiennes in mind for this?
We did at one point, we did. But who knows? The thing about getting a film up and running is, honestly, it's like trying to run with seven plates. You're constantly having to stop and readjust, and who knows when you're going to get where you're actually going.
On the rare occasions when I wrote a score for a film, uh-huh, I learnt not to believe in it at all until I actually saw and heard it on the screen.
Precisely. That's it. People always say, you're not making a film until you're there making the film. But the truth is, even then they might just pull the plug.
We're going to end on opera, and this takes you back to the thing perhaps you love as much as anything in music.
Oh, my goodness me. So this is, first of all, it's Mozart, and you can't beat that. I know there are many people, surprisingly many people, who go, well, I don't really get Mozart. I know some of them myself. I still talk to them. But the truth is, he's sort of unbeatable. However, he is also victim of the thing that we've been talking about, which is an attempt to make something sacred. Quite often when you listen to Mozart's operas, you're listening to something that has seven layers of varnish on it, and you can't quite get the life through that varnish, and the varnish needs to come off. So this is a very specific recording of the Sinfonia, the overture from The Marriage of Figaro.
A brilliant overture.
And it's the piece of music that I knew long before I knew The Marriage of Figaro. You know, as a child, I knew this tune because it's used everywhere. But this is by the former enfant, not so much an enfant now, but still terrible, Theodor Kerensis, the Greek conductor. It completely splits people, this. There are people I know who, and my dad hates this recording. I love this recording. I was put onto it by the pianist James Rhodes, who said to me, this, he said, is what I imagine Mozart was thinking in his head when he wrote this piece of music. Because what you hear in this recording is attack. So if you go and listen to the entire opera, some of the singing isn't the best singing that you'll hear, but the approach that you'll hear, I think, is really interesting and sort of important. Put the best headphones you have on and you'll hear, you know, the wood of the bows hitting the strings of the instruments. It's almost violent, the amount of life and attack that they've put into this recording. Like I say, it's not for everybody. And what it represents for me is an attempt to inhabit music and to make music live rather than just sit there and impress us with its ancient grandeur.
Well, you've issued a health warning to our audience. Yeah. And on that note, it only remains for me to say thank you very much, Chris Addison.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Sinfonia from The Marriage of Figaro, performed by Musica Eterna, conducted by Theodore Kurrensis. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the comedian, actor and director Chris Addison. The programme was produced by Claire Walker, and next week Michael will be talking to the Nobel Literature Prize winner Abdulrazak Gurnah.
Much of our planet still remains unexplored. In this new series of Planet Earth, we travel to the most astonishing wild places and reveal breathtaking animal dramas. Here, life is forced to do things differently.
Enter the new wild. Planet Earth 3. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, on BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, the news now. This is Andrew Peach. The main United Nations relief agency in Gaza says thousands of people have broken into its warehouses in search of food and other supplies. The UN said it was a worrying sign that civil order was breaking down. The health ministry in Gaza, which is run by Hamas, says more than 8,000 people have now been killed in Israeli attacks. Hamas says it's fired rockets into southern and central Israel in response to what it called Israel's massacres of Palestinian civilians. Media reports from Iran say 8 people have been arrested in Tehran's main cemetery during the funeral of a teenager who died after an alleged altercation with the morality police. Amita Garavand, who was 16, had fallen into a coma. Activists say she was assaulted for not wearing a hijab, but the authorities claim she hit her head after fainting. Thousands of people in South Korea's capital, Seoul, have been attending a memorial service for the 159 people killed a year ago in a crush at a Halloween street party. Some survivors and bereaved families are angry that no one has been held accountable for the deaths. An ice hockey player has died in an accident at yesterday's game between Nottingham Panthers and the Sheffield Steelers in the sport's top UK league. Adam Johnson was cut in the neck by a skate blade. The match was abandoned and fans were asked to leave the building while he was treated by paramedics. The Irish Deputy Prime Minister, Micheál Martin, says UK government ministers need to be careful when discussing possible changes to the terms of a referendum on Irish unity. He was speaking after the Northern Ireland Minister in Westminster, Steve Baker, suggested a referendum on a united Ireland should require the support of a supermajority instead of the current simple majority of 50% plus one. Mr. Martin said politicians should focus on practical things. The weather, windy and cloudy with rain in Scotland, mainly in the east. Northern Ireland will turn drier and brighter later. Sunny spells elsewhere with showers in southern England and Wales. Highs of 14 in Cardiff, 13 in London and Belfast, 10 in Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News.
Drama on 3.
To speak or not to speak? That is the question.
Shakespeare, but not as you know it.
King Hamlet remains seriously ill in hospital.
Two modern retellings of Hamlet, a story of betrayal, deceit and revenge.
Above all, to thine own self be true.
I might not this believe without the sensible and true avouch of mine own eyes.
That's what I said.
Thou didst ever, thy dear father, love revenge his